This is Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Here are your hosts, Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Johnny Lupinacci, educated educators talking education.
Yes, of course it is. Tim and Johnny, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk. Educated educators talking education. Homeroom.
Getting right.
Ready. Regroup. Johnny Lupinacci, Jess. What's happening, my two friends?
Well, it's homeroom, Tim. It's good. It's another week, another series of Busted Pencils drops. Just loving it. Loving the interaction.
Best way to start
listeners.
The week.
Best way to start the week, like Jess said.
Jess, I tell you too, I mean, the whole idea of homeroom Monday mornings, are you excited before you come into this homeroom every day?
Of course I am, Tim.
Hey, just want to make sure.
We got some news to dig into it.
Got some great news. However, Jess, before the news, in case anybody wants to call and drop us a note in that mailbag, 608-557-8577, 608-557-8577. Just before we get started there, in case anybody's like, wait a minute, I want to comment right now. Pick up that phone, give us a call, put us a note in that mailbag. Jess, but though, in the news, what's happening?
Well, in the news, we've got lots happening, but let's dig into two stories. Starting off, Higher Ed Dive. The American Association of University Professors says DEI statements can be valuable to faculty recruiting. They have endorsed the use of diversity, equity, and inclusion statements in academia and rejected the idea that including DEI criteria in faculty evaluation is antithetical to academic freedom. Instead, they say colleges should include faculty in all stages of DEI policy development, implementation, and revision.
Mm-hmm. Including the DEI. So, Johnny, this is, okay, coming out of our reality that we're living today, the past 2023, 2024, the attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion, coming all the way into the standpoint where states, individual states have, quote, outlawed some forms, particularly in state institutions that receive public monies, the idea that including or requiring a diversity, equity, and inclusion statement is actually discriminatory to do that, and that could be a violation also of academic freedom. AAUP, hey, love what they're saying. They're like, no, sorry. Actually, DEI, it makes sense, and it makes things better.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a no-brainer. I mean, I don't even like to give too much attention to so-called attacks or criticisms of these things. Companies have mission statements, you know, schools all have mission statements and sort of guiding, organizing thoughts, like conceptual frameworks and different things that sort of guide the direction of a company or an organization. We do strategic plannings, all these things. And so it shouldn't be shocking to people that universities, by and large, that's what we're talking about
that's
here.
That's what we're talking about.
Wouldn't have a commitment to democracy, to having human rights, to having equity and equality valued, right? That universities would want to improve our communities in these areas. So, I mean, this is a strategic plan. These DEI statements have gotten a bad rap in terms of, like, they've caught the attention of people who want to try and poke at something.
Right.
But they've been around forever, whether they've been called DEI statements or not. And actually, I shouldn't say they've been around forever. They're an important improvement on what was.
Right.
But the process of faculty, students, and a community that are part of an organization, and companies do this too, coming together and figuring out strategically the direction they want to go and defining that and making that clear. I think it's unfair if you don't have a statement, because we're hiring people into these communities under the premise that they're going to be contributing to making the world a better place, or our state a better place, or our community. Or if I'm hiring somebody to be an instructor in engineering, that they're making those students who are going into engineering better for the world and for the community, and better engineers. And so those that should be transparent. Yeah. I say it all the time. I'll be really clear about it. I work with other faculty, and sometimes I have to say point blank, look, if you don't agree with this, you don't have to work here. It's not like you had to decide to take this job and all of a sudden you are surrounded by people who are committed to social justice. It's as clear as day.
Right.
On all of the materials. And so I agree with the AAUP 10 times out of 10 times because, you know, I'm a union guy.
Yeah, you're a union guy, but I just, you know, but they put this forward and I just think that got to just take an opportunity to reframe it or rephrase it to look at the criticism of diversity, equity, and inclusion statements. Some said these are against free speech because they were turned into kind of like a pledge that you had to make a statement about your commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And by mandating that you absolutely uphold diversity, equity, and inclusion, that mandate was a trespass against your free speech rights, and that no one should be compelled to state and put their beliefs, you know, I guess put their beliefs on their back of their jean jacket for everybody to see, that free speech allows you to be silent on these issues.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between free speech and having the ability to say and believe what you want and finding a place where you have peers and you're working to build something towards those common goals. As Johnny said, it's not unusual for any organization to have a mission statement, for people to come together and say, these are the things we believe, this is what we're working towards. This is nothing different.
But it's a mandatory belief in diversity, equity, and inclusion. The state is imposing. I see both of you guys giving me that dirty look, man. Holy crap.
Mandatory according to who? You have a choice. That's what I tell people. And like, it's also your right to disagree, but you might not get your way. And that's something to remember. Like,
so I won't get hired then, is what you're saying. So if I don't believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion, I should be excluded from getting a state-funded, public taxpayer-allocated position at your university, really? Because I wanted to not, you know, uphold, or I didn't want to make transparent my beliefs. So by me keeping my beliefs silent, I should be allowed to be discriminated against for being silent.
Come on.
Well, you're
man.
Not discriminated against. I mean, there's a far cry. You're not being discriminated against. You have a right to your beliefs, but you're not being discriminated against for your beliefs. All right. If your beliefs are harmful to the general public and you keep them to yourself to get a job, that's your, you made a couple of choices there. Now that you have that job, if you're expressing your right to dissent, that's fine to have that right to dissent, but we're not changing for you. You just made a bad choice to work somewhere that doesn't align with your beliefs. And there are states that have said, these are our, if you are choosing to work in a state funded place, you can believe what you want, but you'll work towards these common goals. And so I think let's not over essentialize it, Tim. If you're maybe like the world's leading expert in plastic coatings, and we're hiring you because we want you to teach our students, you know, the information that you have, and your beliefs are not aligned to the beliefs of the institution, it's our job to be transparent about the beliefs and the directions we're going and the expectation of your job. It's your job to decide if that works for you or not. And you have the right to choose. And should you choose to join the group, then you're on the horn for that.
Man, I don't know, though. You guys are framing this as if I really believe that. I was just trying to put out a little devil's advocate position. If you liked that position or if you disliked Tim's position, 608-557-8577, that's the number. Let us know. You know, you can always give us the feedback in our mailbag to let us know what you're thinking, or especially if to express anger and disdain for Dr. Tim Slucker, 608-557-8577. Higher education news, Jess. I think we have one more story too, right?
We sure do.
What do we got?
The Washington Post.
Whoa.
College rankings are leaving out the most important factor. Jonathan Zimmerman, author of The Amateur Hour, A History of College Teaching in America, says, trying to choose a college based on how well it teaches, good luck. If you consult the rankings, like the U.S. News and World Report survey that bills itself as a tool for finding the right school, you can learn about everything from how much a college costs to how much debt its students incur and how much they donate as alumni. But one thing you can't find out, how well its professors teach.
Teaching? Wait, what? At a university? It matters? Yes, it does. You know what, too? And I'm glad, Jess, you picked this story today because, you know, we're going to have an episode coming up in the future where actually that author, Jonathan Zimmerman, we have a chance to sit down and really do a deep dive with him and all of the research he's done over the years on quality college teaching. But yeah, the idea that when you're picking a college, and I think about this, Johnny, you're going to be getting ready at some point here. You got the younger ones coming into a college. Mine have now finished and picked. The decision about how to pick a college, and as long as I've been in higher education and believe in high quality teaching, I got to say that I don't think that was something that I really looked at in depth to say, hey, my son's going to come to this college. Can you tell me about how great the professors are at actually teaching? I might have said, tell me how great the professors are. And like, oh, they're great people. They love spending time with the students. They do after hours work with them. They have great office hours. But the idea of a parent, particularly, let's frame this as a parent, that a parent says, I'm only sending you to a college where they actually are really great at teaching. That's a paradigmatic flip, Johnny Lupinacci.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, I thought that name sounded familiar when Jess said it. I was hold on a minute. I think we just might have talked to a guy with similar set of information and really awesome stuff to say about why quality instruction matters and how, sadly, how few and far between knowing if it actually happens is out there. And I know that it does in many places. So just when we talk about this, say, you know, we're in the front lines. We see some amazing teaching happening at all different types of schools. But these rankings don't really tell us that. Mm-mm. And it ought to be the most important to me, I think, the most important reason a school is ranked or a school is chosen is it's a great fit for whoever the learner is going there. And that's why we have different types of schools. So I get excited about thinking about what are the things happening to double down and ensure that higher education isn't just more schooling or worse schooling. You know, I'm always talking about the difference between schooling and education, Tim. Maybe we do a whole little special on that sometime soon. Caller, if you got a question about the difference between schooling and education, give us a call or a text at 608-557-8577. But Tim, I get excited about this because as a teacher, you're always learning to be a better teacher. And it's rare that that's supported, acknowledged, or understood as an ongoing learning process. So you know, we've been teaching a long time. Over the years of teaching, I've learned more and more the things that students need and that help improve instruction.
Right.
And they've changed over time. And so, but I will say, rarely in my career has it been incentivized, awarded, or recognized. It's sort of been this altruistic also conflict of interest with my other responsibilities. There was this idea that said like, hey, you're a professor. Your job is primarily to write articles, sometimes maybe write some grants, depending on where you're a professor, folks. You know this. Our job is primarily to be researchers and teachers. But the research end of things is highly recognized, rewarded, and incentivized. The teaching end of stuff is often known as, well, you just got to kind of do it. And you know, at this age, they should be good enough to be learning on their own anyways. And so they're just kind of learning from you. Having you around is the privilege that they get from being, you know, at this school, being around great researchers. Well, that's not education. That's not even schooling. That's just, you know, kind of some real problematic ways of thinking how kids might learn or young people might learn just by being around somebody.
Think about the assumption, Johnny, that's embedded in that. And I know you and I have talked about this when we've had conversations with Jonathan Gierko, the president of the Association of College and University Educators, AQ, is that there's an assumption that deep knowledge, the PhD, the ability to do research, there's just a kind of like a blanket, well, of course they're good teachers. They know everything there is to know about their subject matter. That, of course, makes them a great teacher. And that assumption has largely operated in higher education as, quote, the mark of being a quality teacher. The reality is that what you're saying about this, Johnny, and what Jonathan Zimmerman's pointing out in this article and his book, and in fact, when you catch his extended podcast that we'll be releasing in a couple of weeks, you'll get to really dig deep into, is that quality teaching, high quality teaching, we actually don't do anything real systematic and formalized in higher education that recognizes truly what a standard of high quality teaching would be. And that reminds me when Jonathan Gierko was talking about saying the fear that colleges would go through if there was a ranking that said number of faculty qualified to teach. I don't know if you remember that when he talked about that, that whole three words, he said qualified to teach would upset academia, higher education in a way where they're going, who's going to make that decision? What do you mean qualified to teach? Our faculty are world-renowned scholars. Of course they're qualified to teach. But hey, Jess, I'm just wondering what you're thinking. You've been there, you know, quality teaching matter, and would it matter to you if you could truly choose based on your ability to say, hey, this is truly a quality institution because they're in.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Go, okay.
So in my undergraduate experience, I was very privileged to go to a fantastic school where it's a wonderful, wonderful learning establishment. It's also an R1 institution. So they prioritize research really, really heavily. Sometimes that's great.
Mm-hmm.
I remember distinctly taking some organic chemistry courses where I had an instructor who was, you know, he's a national leader of organic chemistry research. And as a teacher, really, really not equipped with the skills that he needed to lead that class.
Mm.
You could tell that he knew his stuff. You could tell that he was an expert in organic chemistry.
Mm.
And I did not learn organic chemistry from him. I taught myself organic chemistry, and I learned from a lot of Khan University.
See that? Yeah, that description then too, Johnny, you're talking about that, right? You've given the example, I think actually in this episode, just when we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, people may have expertise in material plastics, right? And in fact, be the world-renowned scholar in certain material plastics, but the ability then to translate it into knowledge that the people sitting in front of them, that students, can actually learn, there was an assumption that of course they know it, so therefore of course they're a good teacher. And the reality though is that no, not really. They do know their stuff, but how to teach it would mean, but see, this is the thing that I think higher education would have a real challenge with some of our colleagues, maybe not our colleagues in colleges and departments of teacher education that we're used to, but across the campus, the idea that we were concerned that more students in our classes weren't learning, and then the ability then to say, I want all of my students to learn, and that assumption that that I think a lot of faculty, I remember in my past, I'm sorry, I'm going to point you guys out, the mathematics faculty were like, look, you got to have at least a 40% failure rate or it's not a good course. They were talking about saying, you know, and so I taught them everything I needed to know about thermodynamics. The fact that they can't repeat it back to me, that just means they're bad learners. It has nothing to do with my bad teaching. A little bit of a ramble there, Johnny.
It's okay, Tim. I like it. And I align with it. You know, I think good teaching is by and large something that we've learned a lot more about. And there, it used to be just fine to be the expert and to, you know about, like Jess was saying, chemistry, and then share that information and let the students figure out. That used to be how students learned. That is not what we know now works best. Mm-hmm. So to bring it full circle, the DEI statement, if we're really committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we're also committed to good teaching, those two things go hand in hand. And things have to change at the university level structure to incentivize it, to support it. Because if I spent the last 15, 20 years being the world's leading expert in plastic coatings, Tim,
okay,
I keep using that, it's likely I wasn't spending that time learning to teach, which is different. Doesn't mean I don't know my stuff. Doesn't mean I don't care about my students. Mm-hmm. I'm excited for them, but there's a gap in my training, right? And so then now I'm teaching, and there has to be support for how to help those folks in higher ed be good teachers. Students, you're certainly paying enough, right? So let's start figuring out how to restructure where there can be that kind of support. Tim, little teaser, I'm going back to school.
No way, man. I said,
you know what? It's time to, I've been doing this for 20 some years. It's time to add on to it. I need to get back to learning to teach myself, not learning to teach to myself, but I need to really focus on my craft a little bit. My research is going strong. It's been going strong. I feel like my teaching's been going strong, but all this conversation, I decided, you know what? Why not? Why not get back into the role of a learner and learn to teach in higher education. So I'm joining some courses put out by AQ. I'm real excited about it. We'll talk more about that soon, Tim. I just wanted to drop it here on the home row because my first class is coming up.
Oh, you nervous?
All the way through the Busted Pencils podcast, we're going to talk about Johnny going back to the classroom, learning to teach in higher ed all over again, just because there's so many new things and there's so much amazing work happening out there for me not to felt irresponsible. So I'm going for it, Tim.
You should be going for it. I appreciate that. And I respect you, Johnny Lupinacci. And you know what? Give Johnny some of that respect too. 608-557-8577. That's the number. You can drop your thoughts. Good college teaching, diversity, equity, and inclusion. What a home room. Johnny, Jess.
Home room.
Loving. Busting pencils. And now it's time for your moment of zen. The future is an infinite succession of presents. Thanks, everybody, for busting pencils. Make sure you join us on Wednesday for a new classes in session. Our guest, Mark Watkins, is going to be talking about artificial intelligence in the classroom. Keep busting pencils.